Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Nick Miles, and in the early hours of Wednesday, the 13th of November, these are our main stories. The ousted Bolivian president, Evo Morales, has arrived in Mexico, saying he was forced to flee his country because his life was in danger. As we record this podcast, attempts in Bolivia to choose a new interim leader have been thrown into confusion by a National Assembly boycott by lawmakers loyal to Mr. Morales. And Montgomery, Alabama, the town at the centre of the US civil rights movement in the 1950s and 60s, has inaugurated its first black mayor. Also in this podcast, we hear from one resident in Gaza about an escalation in the violent conflict with Israel.
We're greatly worried. We've been through this before, and unfortunately people in Gaza have lost hope in resolving the situation.
And the Zimbabwean dollar makes a comeback, but can it avoid the hyperinflation of the past? Bolivia should have had a new leader on Tuesday. Jeanine Añez, the Senate's second vice president, had been expected to be sworn in as interim president during a session of the Legislative Assembly, replacing Evo Morales, who resigned on Sunday. But Mr. Morales' supporters in the Assembly have been boycotting the session, which therefore could not be opened because his socialist movement has a majority in both houses. On Tuesday, the former president himself arrived in Mexico, where he'd been offered asylum. Mr. Morales insists that he was forced from office by a coup. But that is disputed by Mrs. Añez, who said the former president's conduct had been unacceptable.
A coup d'etat is when there are weapons. It is when there are soldiers in the street with weapons taking control by force. But what we have shown to the whole world was this fraud that was committed so that Evo Morales could stand for the fourth term as Bolivia's president, even though we made a decision on February 21st that he could not be a candidate. But he did, and you see how harmful it has been for our country.
I got the latest from our correspondent in La Paz, Katie Watson.
They suspended the session in the Senate. Now the lower house are asking for some guarantees to start the session. So there's been a lot of confusion in the centre of La Paz. And to add to that, there's been a huge march of people from El Alto, which is the second biggest city in Bolivia, which sits just above La Paz. They've been marching in the centre of the capital. Many of those, of course, supporting Evo Morales and criticising the opposition. And really, kind of, there's a lot of anger on the streets, tension that we've seen, especially with, of course, this debate starting to try and name the interim president.
And I suppose adding to that tension are the comments coming out of Mexico City, Evo Morales saying, "I will return with greater strength." So that's not exactly going to calm matters, is it?
No, I mean, the fact that he has left Bolivia does not calm matters at all, and that's what we're seeing on the streets. He said that as long as he lives, he will continue the fight. No doubt he will have a powerful voice. And I think that's the issue, especially with the MAS, the Movement Towards Socialism, his party, is that he is the figurehead of that party. There was no leader named or no successor, and therefore there's this kind of leadership vacuum, if you like. Who will replace him if there are elections called in the next few days? Days or weeks, will that leader end up leading? There's a lot of uncertainty politically happening here in Bolivia.
And certainly to heal Bolivia's wounds, I suppose any future government would have to perhaps put in place some of the policies that Mr. Morales had put in place.
Well, that's the thing. I mean, a lot of people I've spoken to, one lady who said, she was deeply sad about the fact that he'd gone and the concern that it'll, return to the old Bolivia of a deeply divided society. But, I mean, a lot has changed. He has made huge improvements. So I think in some ways Bolivia has moved on.
That was Katie Watson. The killing by Israel of a senior Islamic Jihad commander in Gaza seems to have led to a significant escalation of violence in the dispute between Israel and militants in the Palestinian territories. Baha Abu al-Atta died along with his wife in an airstrike on his home. More than 150 rockets were then fired from Gaza in retaliation. And Israeli warplanes have since carried out more strikes. Here are some views from the Israeli side.
I was 150 meters from here when I heard a huge explosion. I got the feeling immediately that we are talking about on my factory and my place, my warehouse. I ran in and see this catastrophe, everything going on fire.
We immediately ran to the sheltered room. I told my husband to lock it tight. We locked it and heard a scary boom. This boom was so frightening, and I felt it was inside the house.
Well, Najla is a resident of Gaza. She gave her reaction to the assassination and the subsequent exchange of fire to my colleague Paul Henley.
Every few weeks we have some kind of an episode of escalation, but this time is quite different. I would say it started with this the serious assassination of the Islamic Jihad leader, which was perceived by people in Gaza as a major event that reminds us in Gaza with some previous wars, like bigger, really significant escalations. So it is serious, and people are very concerned.
Is he a well-known figure in Gaza, this man who's been killed?
He is, but usually the names are not very popular because they don't go public. They're not on media or anything. But usually within the factions, they have big position, big status, I would say. So,
but among citizens there, among people living in Gaza, will it be a big deal that he personally has been killed?
Being who he is as part of Islamic Jihad, as a leader, yes. But the name may not be known very much by the general public.
And does the firing of rockets from Gaza into Israel have support among people you know?
To put it in a way that this is how Palestinian factions have been partially responding to such violations by Israel on such attacks. But you also should remember that the situation in Gaza has been fueling for the past years without any resolution. And
I suppose what I'm trying to find out is whether there is generally public support in Gaza for firing more rockets into Israel in direct response to this killing.
People do expect that this to happen. Some agree and some disagree. I can't give you exact figures on how popular exactly this kind of response is.
Sure. How worried are you that the situation will spiral into more violence on both sides now, though?
We are very worried, to be honest. We are waiting to see how things develop tonight. It's been already a heavy day since 5:30 a.m. this morning. But it's been like the past hour or so kind of quiet, and everyone is just watching the news and waiting to see what will come out. So we're greatly worried. We've been through this before, and unfortunately people in Gaza have lost hope in resolving the situation because it's been just failing. We've been failed by everyone, and we've been punished by all sides. And the situation is really dramatically deteriorating within Gaza in terms of the very basic aspects of life. We're under blockade, we're under serious restrictions. 2 million people are not able to move, not able to work. Increase of unemployment is massive. And I think this doesn't make news, unfortunately. But people's lives are being really compromised by the day. And everyone, even those who consider themselves advantaged, they do suffer from basic rights such as movement, electricity, proper water, etc. And the economic situation is deteriorating dramatically. And people would probably know that unemployment has reached the highest in the world. So the situation has been really boiling. And unfortunately, people are not hopeful.
That was Najla, a resident of Gaza. Now to a bank in southern Africa. 16, 17, 18. Where a man in Zimbabwe's capital, Harare, was carefully counting the money he'd just withdrawn. Perhaps a mundane act in most parts of the world, but there were long queues in the city because this was the first time in a decade that people have been able to take out Zimbabwean dollars. The currency was scrapped in 2009 because hyperinflation meant it had become almost worthless, with $100 billion notes in circulation. So will the new dollar perform any better? Shingai Nyoka reports from Harare.
There have been long lines outside banks since the early hours of the morning. As Zimbabweans desperate to get their hands on what is essentially the first official currency in 10 years. There's been a desperate shortage of cash over the last few years, and the central bank is hoping that by injecting almost $1 billion in hard cash will alleviate that. But the denominations that are being withdrawn are the $2 and $5 notes. That's equivalent to about 30 US cents.
I just think it is going to fuel inflation. I don't think it is going to change much. Nothing will change actually.
If they reintroduce like the rands, you know, I think it'll be better than to keep on adding these new currency, like adding new notes or coins or bonds.
But critics say that such low denominations in a high inflation environment is useless. $5 doesn't even buy a loaf of bread here. But the government says it's doing so so that it can control inflation. The government has a checkered past with money management. And in the past, whatever money came onto the market went directly to the black market where it was traded for a premium. Now, the last time Zimbabwe had a local currency, it collapsed spectacularly. And the people that are withdrawing money here are hoping that this currency won't go the same way.
That was Shingai Nyoka reporting from Harare. Montgomery, Alabama, the town at the epicenter of the US civil rights movement in the 1950s and 60s, has inaugurated its first black mayor. Stephen Reed, a Montgomery County judge, was elected last month. His victory comes more than 60 years after the city became the site of the first bus boycott inspired by Rosa Parks. A decade later, it was the destination of the Selma to Montgomery protest march to demand voting rights for African Americans. Well, Stephen Reed spoke at his inauguration on Tuesday.
What we can never be again is a divided city. What we can never be again is a divided Montgomery. We have to restore the belief that we are the masters of our fate, the captains of our souls. So in this shining moment, at the intersection of history and possibility, a new Montgomery is unfolding, a new Montgomery that includes all of our citizens.
Well, I got more on Stephen Reed, the man, and what his plans for the city are from Sophia Charles, the race and ethnicity reporter for the Montgomery Advertiser.
Stephen Reed is now a former probate judge. He has been involved in the city for some time legally, but throughout the campaign, he was really able to kind of tap into a feeling that I think a lot of Montgomeryans have, and certainly certain sects, certain groups of the population, a feeling of being forgotten, left behind, of disinvestment, and really trying to bring those people into the fold and kind of move forward as they try to build a new vision for the city.
And when we talk about those people, are we talking about disenfranchised African Americans?
Yes, definitely. There are portions of the city, specifically in West Montgomery, where it almost looks like a time capsule. You can see that there hasn't been historically much investment in the area. Things haven't changed. People are dealing with a lot of issues like blight. You know, they're dealing with a lot of issues like crime. And they feel that their needs have not been historically met and have not been centered and have really not been included. So, I mean, there are certain areas. There's an area called Newton where there's brown water coming out of people's taps. It's been like that for over a year. So there are definitely groups who feel as if they have not fully been brought into the fold. They have not been a part of the changes and part of the revitalization that is happening in Montgomery. And I think that they see in Stephen Reed a candidate, or now a mayor, who is interested in bringing them in and talking with them and hearing their concerns and in improving those conditions.
You're painting a portrait of a city that perhaps more than half a century since the civil rights movement in the US really hasn't moved on very much. Would you say that he has the support of the white population of Montgomery as much as African Americans?
I'd say so. It's not that the city hasn't moved much. It's that certain pockets of the city haven't moved much. I think that people are aware that the communities are divided. there's a sense that in order to move forward, that people really need to come together and kind of, you know, just push forward. So I think that it's not just the African-American population that's supporting him. The city is now about 60% African-American. So, of course, that is a large part of the support that he's received. But I do think that there are many white Montgomeryans who believe in this vision, who want to see a new Montgomery, who want to see a deeper investment across the city, citywide. And I think that overall, Stephen Reid has the city behind him.
That was Sophia Charles from the Montgomery Advertiser. You're listening to the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. Still to come, Spain's socialists agree to work with the hard-left Podemos party in an attempt to form a stable coalition government after yet another inconclusive election.
It's a good news for progressives. It's good news for Spanish politics. It's good news for Europe. And it's good news for Catalonia.
There's expected to be some tough talking later on Wednesday when the Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan meets Donald Trump at the White House. At issue, two subjects that could threaten Ankara's continued NATO membership. The first concerns last month's military incursion into an area of northern Syria controlled by US-backed Kurdish fighters. The second, the country's purchase of the Russian S-400 missile defence system, which it's claimed could compromise NATO's security. What exactly has led to the rift between these two NATO members, and how worried should we be? Mike Thompson reports from Istanbul.
More than 1,000 metres across the sea, Istanbul's Bosphorus Bridge links Europe to Asia. This in a country that straddles the divide between Christianity and Islam, where East meets West. Yet some fear that this strategically vital NATO ally is no longer the friend it was. Tensions with the West came to a head last month with the Turkish incursion into neighbouring northern Syria, where, with Russian assistance, it's driven out US-backed YPG Kurdish forces.
Making a cooperation with Russians was left the only option to have real results in Syria, to penetrate into Syrian land, to create a safe, secure zone for Turkey. This was the only option.
Osman Sert, research director of the Ankara Institute think tank, insists that Washington had clearly signalled its approval for this, despite later denials. Economist Ibrahim Turhan fears that new sanctions against Ankara, proposed by the US House of Representatives, could further cement Turkey's ties with Russia.
Turkey is dependent in terms of energy, its defense industry, and especially after what happened in Syria, Turkey will become again dependent to Russia in terms of its foreign policy.
Up a steep flight of stairs off a busy Istanbul street, I meet Ünal Çerikus, deputy chair of the opposition Republican People's Party. Mr. Çerikus says he understands why the West is so concerned about his country's purchase of Russia's S-400 missile defence system.
It creates a kind of a security threat to the whole NATO system, because their radars will be receiving and intercepting all kinds of NATO activities in the neighbourhood.
Is that something that would be receivable by the Russians because it's their own system?
Yes, and there will be some serious effort of espionage or intelligence gathering.
Ever since Recep Tayyip Erdogan became Turkey's prime minister in 2003, Islam has played an increasingly prominent role in life here. And some believe that this fact, even though Turkey remains officially a secular state, helps explain why it's still being shunned by the EU.
This coincides with the rise of Islamophobia, terrorist attacks of the jihadists, and with the rise of migrants coming to Europe.
Though Barçın Yunaç, a columnist on Turkey's oldest English-language newspaper, Hürriyet Daily News, says Turkey needs NATO, and NATO needs Turkey, so we shouldn't panic about that just yet.
We in Turkey have lived through so many crises with the West. We will have a period of tension, there will be a war of words, but then always an understanding was reached at the end of the day.
That report was by Mike Thompson. In Uganda, dozens of people arrested at a bar in Kampala, popular with the LGBT community, have appeared in court charged with being a common nuisance. Some community members see the arrests as an attempt to shut down places where they feel welcome, but police insist they're not targeting individuals because of their sexuality. Catherine Biarohanga reports from Kampala.
The magistrate's court in central Kampala was not equipped to handle the 67 accused, six of whom are women. There were so many that they had to appear in three separate courtrooms, but there weren't enough state prosecutors available. Lawyers for the suspects described the charges of common nuisance as general, giving arresting officers too much power. Only 29 of the accused had prosecutors present in their courtroom and could enter pleas. All pleaded not guilty. All 67 suspects have been remanded in custody and will appear in court over the next 2 weeks to enter pleas and apply for bail. Some of the friends of those charged were crying outside the court and shared stories of how the climate was getting worse for gay people in Uganda. But the authorities still insist the community is not being singled out.
Catherine Biarohanga. Spain's ruling socialists and the far-left Podemos party have agreed the terms for a coalition government, just 2 days after elections failed to deliver a conclusive outcome. This new agreement came unexpectedly fast, as our Madrid correspondent Guy Hedgeco explains.
Podemos are the most natural ally, many people feel, for the socialists. You know, they are a left-wing party and they do sort of share many things in common. But I should point out that these two parties were in talks earlier this year, things got really quite rancorous and bitter between them, and they really couldn't agree on much at all. And the talks eventually collapsed, and that led to this Sunday's election. So I think what surprised many people was they reached this agreement so quickly. But I think they have a lot of things in common in certain areas, social areas particularly, but certain differences as well, for example, in economic policy. The speed with which they reached this, well, what is a preliminary agreement, was a result of the pressure really from ordinary Spaniards. I think voters are fed up with voting so much. We've had four elections in 4 years, two general elections this year. And I think the onus has been very much on the politicians now to reach an agreement quickly so that there's no prospect of yet another election.
Just how convinced then are the socialists that this time they will be able to build a stable coalition government? Especially when, even with Podemos' support, they still won't have the support of a majority of MPs. That was a question Paul Henley put to one of the Socialist Party's European Parliament MEPs, Xavi López.
No, it's the first step. We will need more supports, but it's clear that politics in Spain has to avoid this political deadlock that we have.
The trouble is, you've got a smaller mandate now after this election than you did before. If you combine Podemos and the socialists, yeah, you've got fewer seats between you. That's not such a strong mandate, is it?
It's true. The parliament will be fragmented. We will need more negotiations, compromises. But this is part of the new politics that we have in Spain. And this is part of the political landscape that we share with the rest of our member states here in Europe.
Well, Podemos didn't want you before the election, weakened now. Is that why they'll have you?
Well, we will see Podemos, no? We only lost 2% of the seats that we got last April. They will be 7 seats less than they got this April. But the point here is not the balance between both. We will have a coalition government. We are trying to focus our conversations in policies and the program, and this is the main thing.
And are you prepared to share political trust now with Catalonia and with independence campaigners?
Well, I'm Catalan and I know pretty well what is going on in Catalonia. And I think that the new government, the deal made by Podemos and the Socialist Party, it's a good news for progressives. It's good news for Spanish politics. It's good news for Europe and it's good news for Catalonia. Why? Because it will be a pro-dialogue government, obviously respecting our constitutional order and respecting the rule of law, and especially trying to promote dialogue between Catalans, because it's the first thing that we should need, and this is something that it's rejecting this Catalan government.
If nobody can form a stable government soon, what impact will that have on public discontentment with politics generally in Spain? There are a lot of unhappy voters, aren't there?
No, it's true. We must form a government. This is our obligation as politicians. And we have to be clear. If the institutions doesn't work, we are hitting our institutions and we have to protect them. And for this reason, it's really good that two progressive forces built an agreement in 48 hours as a first step to have a stable political system and a stable government in Spain.
Yeah, an agreement that could go the course of 4 years?
We will see, but this should be the goal.
Xavi López. Police in France are trying to find out why hundreds of packets of high-quality cocaine are continuing to be washed up on beaches along the Atlantic coast. Since October, more than 1,000 kilograms of cocaine have been recovered there. Police have warned that handling cocaine is, of course, a criminal offence. From Paris, Hugh Schofield reports.
From Biarritz, near the border with Spain, all the way north to Brittany, the cocaine has been washing up in cellophane-wrapped packets the size of a brick. So regularly is it appearing that police are scanning beaches by helicopter and also conducting spot searches of cars visiting certain beaches. How many packets have been picked up by the curious or the criminally minded is unknown, but one 17-year-old caught with 5 kilos faces prosecution and a possible prison term. No one knows either where the cocaine came from, but the most likely scenario is that it was thrown overboard, possibly from a yacht that was in difficulty. Police are now studying Bay of Biscay maritime records for mid-October.
Hugh Schofield. Superheroes are big business, especially in Hollywood. Go to a cinema anywhere in the world and there's a good chance you'll be able to see a Marvel or DC character brought to life on the big screen. The films have millions of fans, but the acclaimed director Martin Scorsese certainly isn't one of them. He's been attacking the movies in various interviews, and now Marvel has hit back. Charlotte Gallagher has this report.
Black Panther, Captain Marvel and Aquaman. Just a few of the superhero films that have been released in the last few years. They cost millions of dollars to produce, but they can make billions at the box office. Earlier this year, Marvel's Avengers Endgame overtook 2009's Avatar to become the highest-grossing film ever. Critics are embracing the genre. Black Panther became the first superhero movie to be nominated for the Best Picture Oscar and picked up 3 awards at the ceremony in February.
Tell me something. What do you know about Wakanda?
But this success isn't celebrated by everyone, including the man behind one of the most famous lines in Hollywood history.
You talking to me? You talking to me?
The director of Taxi Driver, Martin Scorsese, compared Marvel films to theme parks, complaining that what he called franchise films were keeping others off the screen. In a New York Times opinion piece, he said the films had no revelation, mystery, or genuine emotional danger. Others agreed. The British director Ken Loach said Marvel's output was boring and cynical. Now the head of the Marvel Cinematic Universe, Kevin Feige, has responded to Scorsese's comments, saying they weren't true and unfortunate. He told The Hollywood Reporter that everyone who worked on the films loved cinema and insisted they took creative risks. And anyway, the superhero cinematic juggernaut shows no signs of stopping. Marvel and DC both have new films out next year, and it's widely anticipated that Joker from the DC stable will receive Oscar nominations.
Charlotte Gallagher. And that's all from us for now, but there will be an updated version of the Global News podcast later on. If you want to comment on this edition or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. I'm Nick Miles, and until next time, goodbye.